Scepter Radio Network. Internet radio uncensored, unconstrained, and unleashed. Where sometimes the questions are more dangerous than the answers.
Gray aliens and the harvesting of souls. The conspiracy to genetically tamper with humanity. My guest tonight is a man on a mission, Nigel Kerner. He has written this book, and I'm very honored to have him on the show. I was sent this copy of this book, and I have to tell you that from the moment I saw Nick Redfern's name on here, I immediately paid attention to the foundation of what this book represents, because Nick Redfern is a friend of mine. I spoke with him on a panel, on a very prestigious panel earlier this year. No, actually last year in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Eric Von Daniken, the late Philip Copens, Giorgio Tsoukalos, George Norrie, quite a few individuals of prominence in the field of research of ufology and the paranormal in general were in attendance, and I was honored to be among them. And having spoken with Nick, I walked away with the feeling that, you know, as prolific as he is as a writer, there are many other individuals out there who individuals such as Nick Redfern pay attention to, and one of them is my guest tonight, Nigel Kerner. So let me read to you, before I give you Nigel's bio briefly, I want to read to you what Nick said about this book. Again, the title of the book is Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. You know, the tagline is The Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity. Nigel Kerner's shocking new book totally redefines the nature of the alien presence on our planet. In a detailed study that is certain to send shockwaves throughout the world of UFO research, Kerner offers a terrifying theory to explain the presence of the so-called extraterrestrial grays on our world, a book that should and must be read. And that is from Nick Redfern, who many of you know, and who very shortly will also be on this very same show, Disclosure Radio, here on Scepter Radio Network. My guest tonight, Nigel Kerner, in 1997, first introduced the notion of aliens known as grays coming to Earth, explaining that grays are sophisticated biological robots created by an extraterrestrial civilization they have long since outlived. And many of you who are familiar with my work and my book, UFO Highway, that immediately is going to resonate with you. And most of you who are familiar with John Lear, that's also going to resonate with you, because he refers to these grays as cybernetic organisms that are ancient in design. In this book, Kerner reveals that the grays are seeking to master death by obtaining something humans possess that they do not, souls. Through the manipulation of human DNA, these aliens hope to create their own souls and thereby escape the entropic grip of the material universe in favor of the timeless realm of spirit. Nigel, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Lovely to be on the show, and I'm really, really honored to actually have a kind of, you know, banter with you about this incredibly fascinating subject we're going to talk about, UFOs and the kind of fallout of all of that. And it's very, very nice to know that you know Mike Redfern and so on, because that guy's something very special.
Absolutely. Nigel, take us back in time to when you were first introduced to the concept of UFOs, let alone aliens, and tell us about your initial feelings on the matter. Were you a skeptic? Were you a believer? Were you curious? How did this come about?
Absolutely. Was I a skeptic about it? And it actually came in a very folksy way, Anthony. inasmuch as my son, my younger boy, he was 12 years old at the time, very, very highly hitched up top, you know, and a deep thinker for a 12-year-old and so on, usually putting me on the spot with all his theories or whatever, which he'd already researched, I found, and questions were then asked, and I was found to be wanting in answering them and so forth, and embarrassed amongst his peers. Well, he popped the question to me, just as a little innocent kid would do, "Dad, are UFOs real?" Now, I'm a scientist through and through, and I really don't really contribute towards kind of, you know, these frivolous things as I considered it, you know, Mickey Mouse things like UFOs and so on. Anyway, I was rather fascinated at his actual strength of fascination in this, and I said to him, "Look, hang on a minute, Darren, I have no idea what these things are all about, but I'll tell you this. Look, this really ostensibly on the surface looks really Mickey Mouse, Star Wars, you know, Buck Rogers stuff. You'd do well to get yourself into some serious study about all kinds of, you know, things to do with space or whatever it is." That's more cut out of the textbook and so on, rather than going on film strips and so forth. And I have to be honest with you, I really thought I would come back at him. I said to him, because I wasn't really, you know, kind of into the subject at all, I took a rain check and I said, "Darren, I'll come back to you and I'll give you an answer." Well, I'll tell you what, Anthony, that answer has taken over 30 years of meticulous research, because the moment I started looking into it to give Darren his answer, I began to see that I was actually opening a Pandora's box. That led in a myriad kind of concatenate lines into all kinds of subjects. Existentiality, its full spectrum, seemed to be covered by the places I was going to, you know. I really didn't want this to be. I really thought, this is ridiculous. It can't be so. And the more I thought it was nonsense and ridiculous to actually be doing it and looking at this kind of subject, the more I got fascinated by the fact that there was, in fact, a real root to it all. There really was. And by root, I mean both R-O-U-T-E and R-O-O-T, you know, that kind of thing. So I looked into this rather, began to get more and more serious with it, and I found that it got into the realms of human psychology, it got into the realms of the what I call the soft option stuff, rather than the heavy-based space war, Star Wars, UFOs, hardware, that kind of stuff. I really began to think, look, this this is something that really I should devote a lot more of my time to. And of course, it's now taken me, what, nearly 30 years, actually, of a really serious research, as I say, to be able to come to a conclusion. And that conclusion is, we are in big, big trouble.
Yeah.
Because these things are here. They are verified by the finest minds that can stand testament to it. Experts have actually seen these things, come across them. You've got your Ed Mitchell, that grandee, that a fantastic man with a sense of integrity the moment he opens his mouth. And you've got Gordon Cooper, and I don't have to say to you, you're the expert at this, I'm sure, doing these interviews. A bit of a hero in my mind, may I say, Anthony, that you would go out there and you'd fight the good fight, because the mainstream are switched off. And that in itself is an incredible story. Why are they switched off to something that is so apparently true, when the press club in Washington, with all these illustrious names, are out there shouting, "Hang on, what is this? These things come past the Einsteinian forbiddance of equals MC squared. They have to do that with the distances in space that they have to cover to move, you know. And also, as you know, with Einstein, the closer you get to the speed of light, which is paltry in terms of the distances of space you have to cover between planets, shall we say, that can be occupiable or whatever. But the other thing is that you get near that, and of course mass becomes infinite. Now, how on earth are you going to deal with infinite mass? So obviously there's a huge and powerful hem that stops us from actually doing this business in a kind of terrestrial way. So what other way might there be that these things can come through? How could they do it? In what sense would they have to make their technology such that this could be beaten? And of course that then goes into gravitational and gravity amplifiers and all the rest of it and that kind of thing. And it seems to me now, with the incredible kind of affirmations coming from mobile phone cameras and video cameras and so on all over the world, we have something stupendous here to deal with, and the mainstream is desperately poo-pooing all of this.
Now, well, there's a reason. There's a reason behind the mainstream's decision to neglect the information, which has, you know, come from, you know, many well-established academics and researchers within the fields of ufology and the paranormal, let alone science and the various sciences. You have people coming from the nuclear sector, you know, the semiconductor sector, sectors, and we're seeing that the information that they're trying to share is quietly being, silenced in a way that allows the mainstream media to get away with this, you know, and there's this complicity on the part of the people that are watching this, due to the fact that emotions get involved and people are, you know, they involve pride and shame, and they don't want to be associated with those who dare to ask questions that are on the fringe. And I just made a decision, Nigel. I've decided that tonight's show is going to remain commercial free. We are going to talk for the entire hour uninterrupted. I'm going to forego any advertisement on the show this evening because I think it's important. And more that I read your book, now I told you earlier this evening, I got up to chapter 16, which is the, I believe it's the ghost, Ghost Meets Grey. So that's where I am. I have not quite finished it, but I have decided that from what I have read in this book, that it represents one of the finest examples of compiled information that clearly demonstrates what the purpose is behind this platform of information that exists on these gray aliens is, and how it all began long ago, how there's this ancient component to it. And specifically, in the chapter number 4, Whole Rules, what I found quite compelling was that you had mentioned the Nag Hammadi codices. And what makes the Nag Hammadi codices so special? Well, yeah. A couple of years ago, I spoke with Jay Widener. I don't know if you're familiar with Jay Widener. He's a well-known documentary maker here in the United States who's done work on trying to decipher some of the ideas and the hidden meanings behind Stanley Kubrick's films, which, you know, delve deeply into these secret societies. When you look at the Nag Hammadi codices, and they talk about this off-world group of this off-world group of entities called the Archons, and how they are devoid of a soul. Boom! That immediately resonated with me when I was reading chapter 4 in your book, because the question is, who rules? Who rules us as a species on this planet? And we need to, and before we delve deeper into your book, I want to present you with a few questions, which I know you're going to be able to answer very articulately. Why have we made this exponential leap in technology in the past 60 to 70 years? A truly exponential leap. Our growth in the level of technology is off the charts. Why is that? Why are we so unique as a species from every other group of living organisms on this planet? You know, do you believe that, you know, the gap between the genetic similarities between apes and us as a species is greater than what they're telling us to be? Why don't you take over?
Well, fundamentally, Anthony, the whole business is the wrong way around. I believe when you look at an explanation, as you so rightly point out, an explanation for this massive expression suddenly, from millions and millions of years of evolving as some kind of semi-primitive monkey human, these species of Homo habilis, Homo erectus, and so on, wandering the plains of Africa, happily plucking fruit from the trees, hunter-gatherers, whatever, all of a sudden, a pelvis becomes large enough and a brain becomes large enough in concatenate moments, so to speak, mm-hmm. to play with the two expositions necessary to produce Homo sapiens sapiens. Well, come on. If you're saying that evolution is based upon fortuitous changes that happen, you know, in terms of genes suddenly giving us this, you have to look at the years it would take for such a thing to occur. And previously, even Einstein said, the numbers don't fit. The universe hasn't been there long enough for this kind of change to take place, to produce from a mass of polypeptide chains in some kind of chemical soup, something like a man and something as sophisticated as life. And I looked at this and I thought, this is not possible. It's not, I'm not going to buy this. I can't buy this. Great scientists are saying that there's not enough time for things like this to happen through luck, through chance. What else is there? And how else could we look at this whole system? And then the sensation starts. Supposing we came out with that Big Bang with all this information from one point called the All, and then out of that, because by implication, if there's the All, there's its opposite too. Two things acting together cause Big Bangs to occur because of the potential difference between one and the other. And out of this comes what I think is a mixture of the two. The one side where all information is together as a, I make that a light as a demonstration, a light that comes into the other array, which is obviously the second law of thermodynamics, which says that everything rots. We know everything rots. So how on earth could we go on to make more and more sophisticated platforms when a universal law, Anthony, is breaking everything up?
Exactly.
And going into greater states of randomness and chaos with time. Surely there's an impossible contradiction here. And so I looked at this very calmly and I thought, hey, what if it's the other way around? We come from an educated light, and then as this kind of thing goes to the inertia of breakup and so on, we get smaller and smaller and smaller, if you see what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. It's a wondrous thing I call that point where it's all together. I call it Godhead because I want to make it secular. I want to say that right from the start, I am not a religious person at all. Now, I might have, somebody threw some water on me when I was a baby and called me a Roman Catholic. Then I became a Christian. Now I became, I hope, a little wiser than all of that. You see what I'm trying
to
say?
Sure.
However, in actually looking at it from the perspective of a secular stance as much as possible, as most scientists do, I've come, I'm looking at it the other way around, see that all can be explained if that perspective is taken, that we come from a fantastic whole, and because there is implicitly two opposites in everything, there's a yin, there's a yang, if there's a plus, there's a minus, proton, electron, whatever, it's always an opposite, and the interaction of both creates a huge contradiction enough to mix the two together in explosions, i.e. the Big Bang, and then out of that, all creation happens implicitly. Implicitly as it goes along. When I looked at it that way, this business about threading an accidental point of inorganic chemistry mm-hmm. into organic chemistry and all that nonsense of making something from fundamentals into grand scales just slipped away, and you know what? What happens then? What happens then is that our species produces the ape in front of us. We don't come from chimpanzees. We go to our own monkey version. And so our particular version on this planet is busy, and our various racial groups, as they go lesser and lesser with time because of entropy, because of the second law, it becomes lesser and lesser into a point where we have different types of apes and monkeys for the different families of humanity we've got.
That's very interesting, Nigel. So when we decide to focus on the DNA, for instance, what it forces us to do is to rethink our lineal origin. And I don't know if you're familiar with this or not. Well, I'm sure you are. There's this 30-year-old evolutionary argument asserting that there is a 98.5% similarity found to exist in DNA between humans and chimpanzees. My firm belief is that it is wrong. Back in 2010, there were facts that were coming out of the scientific community, which were raising the figure to as high as 99% similarity in our two respective genomes, between human and chimpanzee. And I knew, based on research that I had been conducting, that was just plain wrong. There were many scientists and geneticists who reevaluated a lot of that data. We're talking about preeminent scientists and research geneticists. And they knew that those figures were misleading. Now, it was strange, Nigel, that those figures are what the mainstream media was telling us. This is back in 2010, and they continue to do so today. When as far back as 2005, very prominent geneticists were sequencing the complete chimpanzee DNA genome, and they knew after just a few years worth of research that there were many major differences that forced them to rethink this idea that the chimpanzee essentially was the foundation of our ancestral lineage, our genetic lineage. There was a Dr. Richard Buggs. This was in 2008. He was a PhD out of the University of Oxford, and he is a research geneticist today at the University of Florida. And he had published an online article that stated that the real similarity between humans and chimpanzees, when looking at a side-by-side comparison of the fully sequenced genomes, was less than 70%. That kind of information was being completely ignored. Just this year they tried to redefine this whole aspect of the genome referred to as junk DNA. That's still out there. I don't know, where that's going to lead us. However, when I look at all this disparate data and all of this information that is being suppressed by the mainstream media from very, very prominent research geneticists and scientists, it makes guys like me, a fellow researcher, dig deeper into the information that is out there that is being suppressed, and asking the questions, asking questions such as, why are they suppressing it? And time after time, I find that everything that they're telling us is a lie. And everything that we know is radically different, in the sense that it will redefine everything, including religion.
I think that it comes down to a very simple point, Anthony, and that's vanity, human vanity. There is nothing as powerful as that. We spend billions of dollars actually cultivating vanity through fashion. Absolute frivolous nonsense makes no difference to our eternal scale and the wonder of our natural humanity. That's the key. Now, you were talking about DNA. Between 4 and 5% of our genes actually code for proteins. So the regulatory functions have been found, if you like, to be small in proportion. 95% does not do that. But the most recent research finds that there is some kind of scale of action of this 95%, and it's not as profound as actually making proteins. Now, the vast sections of DNA that would actually consist of what we call repeat codes, you know, ALUs, trinucleotide repeats, all these kinds of things, I believe is a result of gray genetic manipulation. I mean this synthetic, robotic, quantum computer programmed things that come from out there, that they intercepted the DNA in some kind of way, and in order to create out of us as a quantum of being, of beings, if you like, a suitable kind of being for them to actually download their own machineness and create, if you like, what they're actually going to do, and I'm afraid millions will buy into it, transhuman type beings, so that these things can actually use a natural, glorious thing that comes from a beginning with the universe, like us, you know, and use this for their own purposes, a vehicle that can reproduce naturally. Machines, these are machines. Sure. They are actually a glorified vacuum cleaner, if you like.
Wow.
You know, we have to see the perspective of these things. Now, the clue is in the fact that these kind of repeat codes of DNA are highly suggestive of cloning procedures. Scientists, you know, working on the human genome, a project as such, are beginning to believe that these codes have a role in actually regulating gene activity. They've found that, and now they're going on to try to understand why are they repeats? What is the purpose of the same darn thing going on and so on all the time? Mm-hmm. Now, I'll give you an argument that a great scientist actually made once. A chap called Fred Hoyle is an Englishman, and he's on the scale up there with the Newtons and the great ones like Darwin and so on. This guy said, imagine a blindfolded person trying to solve a Rubik's Cube, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If our blindfold subject were to make one random move every second, random move, now I say, every second, it would take him an average of 300 times the age of the Earth, right? That's 1,350 billion years to solve the cube. These odds are roughly the same as you could give an idea, if you like, just one of our body's proteins to have evolved randomly by chance. So we use about 200,000 types of protein in our cell. If the odds against random creation of one protein are the same, if you like, as those against the random solution of the Rubik's Cube as such, then the odds against the random creation of all 200,000 are almost unimaginably vast. And it was on this that Einstein based his premise and said, the numbers don't fit. It had to be genetic interception, and it had to be non-fortuitous. It was deliberate. And so the point is, I try to base what our conclusions come on common sense. Now, why don't we want to look there? What is holding us back in looking there, all science, and saying, hang on a minute, it's the other way around. Isn't it easier for something already together to break down, i.e. the second law of thermodynamics is doing that anyway, than to come from something completely basic and build up these incredibly sophisticated stances that give rise to us when the numbers that would be taken into consideration to make this a fortuitous principle would be, the universe would be far, far, far older than it is now. And so it's very simple common sense I use to actually postulate my argument.
Absolutely.
And that,
Go ahead. Yeah,
and that you know, is the crux of it all. What is it about us that is so fantastic? Why are these highly sophisticated things, these machine things that can come from out there, vast distances, why are they bothering with what seems to be a relatively simple type of natural being? Well, I'll tell you what, It's our naturalness that is such a wondrous thing. We come all the way back through our dads, our mom, our granddads, our great-granddads, our great-grandmas, and so on, all the way back. You know, you individually, Anthony, is connected to this postulation of that primacy, that singularity, that where all information was together once upon a time. We all are. Mm-hmm. And we come in this wonderful line. And that is simply, to me, a soul. That line of information that begins with the universe and therefore has to go beyond it to whatever begun that, has to have a premise before that. Well, all that comes down to now. Now, if we are that precious and rare in this universe, and we make robots and roboids, we better be sure how we program those fantastically artificially intelligent things, because I'll tell you what, if we don't get the difference between us and them right, so that they can leave us alone, and we tell them, look after yourselves, you know, if you want, in order to look after us, you've got to take care of yourselves. If you give them that premise, and we don't tell them how different we are from them, they're going to see one day that we are the biggest threat of all. We can pull the plug. We are the creators. So they could take us out. Now, I believe that's what's happened out there. And these things have been out there in space looking for dangers to their own prime beings, like all natural beings of their planet, like us, like we are prime beings for our planet. And they've taken these people out, these things out. And they're now roaming everywhere. So under a program, not vicious, not wicked, they're just following a program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lesson to us all, do not make artificially intelligent anything. Do not do it until you can tell them the difference between us, i.e., how do you describe feeling, imagination, all these abstracts, to a robot in a program. You can't. So don't make them at all. Because if you can't show them the difference, finally, fundamentally, between us and their simple 0-1 expletive to liver to existing, you are in big danger.
And that's interesting. Let me interrupt really quickly. Interject. I'm sorry, because I don't want to lose this thought that I have based on everything that you're saying. I'm not sure if you are aware of this, but I'm a software engineer, and I've been developing software since I was 10 years old. I'm 42 now, so you know I have a very, very long history of developing algorithms, subroutines, and functions, and I've even developed my own operating system at one point. And it's interesting, when I look at it from that perspective, this is what I'm taking away from everything that you're telling me. One, we represent a couple of things here. One, we represent a chassis. But two, what humans possess and what the artificial or these artificial entities do not possess, I'm certain you're alluding to this, which is the soul, and which makes perfect sense when you're looking at the Nag Hammadi codices and you're reading about the archons, which do not possess souls. Essentially, the soul represents information, and it represents information on a level that they are incapable of attaining. And it appears to me that we have this intrinsic ability to tap into our soul, understand much of what it represents, and help us to define us as individuals, but more importantly, to define our humanity. Earlier, when you were talking about the genetic aspect, and you gave that wonderful analogy with regards to the Rubik's Cube, it made me think as to the evidence that exists to prove that even further. There's the fact that the higher primates have 48 chromosomes, whereas humans only have 46, and that there's evidence now showing that those two missing chromosomes are not missing at all. There was a Dr. Ken Miller, who was a biology professor and both a molecular and cellular biology expert from Brown University, who had found that in humans, what would be the second and third chromosomes in a higher primate have been carefully and deliberately fused into one single chromosome. And they literally found the trace evidence that had been left behind in our genes, showing that our genome, in fact, differs from all other species on Earth, but not through natural mutation, but through intervention. They know where the fusion actually took place. They located at chromosome number 2. The precise fusion site had been located at base numbers 114 million something and 114 million something else. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. But they were showing that that chromosome number 2 is unique to our lineage, and that it emerged as a result of the head-to-head fusion of two chromosomes that remain separate in other primates. So what does that tell us, Nigel? That tells us that, one, we were genetically intervened. Somebody or something manipulated our genome, preparing us for two things. One, to service as a model for a future chassis for these artificial entities, and two, potentially so that they could understand how to attain our soul as a model for recreation. Now, you talk about this repetitive component in the genetic model. Maybe they have been, you know, studying that model, you know, over time for, you know, the eventual extraction and utilization of the soul for their own purposes. And again, when we're talking about the soul, I think that it, like you alluded to, it represents a tremendous amount of information, of knowledge that is multi-generational, going back, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of generations. Also, one final thing before I let you take over again. I think that it's important for people to understand that right now in our society, artificial intelligence, it is something that is being thrust upon us at I'm not going to say an exponential rate, but a very strong rate of, for instance, let's take a look at the fact that the iPhone? The iPhone has this artificial intelligence component called Siri. And Siri essentially is a sentient entity within the device that literally responds to you. I mean, you can ask Siri, Siri, where is the best place for me to dump a dead body? Now, it will actually tell you and give you directions and talk to you as if it were a sentient entity. The difference is that we know that it is just a compilation of subroutines and algorithms meant to fool us into believing that it's communicating with us, when it's not really anything. It's not sentient, but it's something that they're trying to achieve. It's something that they're trying to reach, and they're almost there. But there's a lot that is lacking. And I think that it would be extremely dangerous should they ever tap into the human soul. Go ahead, Nigel.
I'll give you a model here. This, if I may, Anthony. Mm-hmm. I don't want to interrupt you because you were going wonderfully there about this whole premise about mobile phones. I'll give you a wonderful analogy with mobile phones and how these things can be seen, as in simple terms, to be the property of something much more intelligent than ours, to our detriment. Now, what do we do when we make a message on a mobile phone? And I'm going to compare this to the soul and how our soul's information system may be tapped into. Now, take this message you make on a mobile phone. That's a unique aggregation of your ideas, if you like, right? As you make the message up, you're tapping this out, and you know that you've made a unique thing to whoever you want to send the message. You press a button, and that thing goes through the walls. It's invisible. You don't see it go. It goes through the walls, and maybe 10,000 miles away, whoever you're sending the message to, retaps that phone, and he receives this parcel of coherent assembly, shall we call it, mm-hmm. in an instant of time, okay? Now, supposing we, as a entity, are in fact just more sophisticated than a mobile phone. We really are, because we have imagination, we have other dimensions to our making of messages, if you like, as human beings. And if you ask how that electronics is done, we have a pump which animates the message. We have a iron mechanism, hemoglobin in the blood, which goes in a circuit, it forms a coil, it forms an electromagnetic scenario. Supposing that life is actually propagated so that we can understand, perceive, and manipulate information, but in a hugely more sophisticated scale than the simple algorithms of a mobile phone. And when we die, the circuit stops, and this highly sophisticated algorithm is then released as an individual. And I would then call that hugely sophisticated algorithm a soul. So it's a kind of field, a unique individualized field with the information and experience of that person, a human being, that goes on and on. It's indestructible, but it can be hacked into, Anthony. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll tell you what. You can hack into a mobile phone, can you not? There have been, obviously, all through the world, vast instances of this. In the same way, supposing an intelligence there with quantum computers and artificial intelligence are, in fact, just simply the makers of this kind of mechanism like a mobile phone makes, transmitting information mechanisms, right? These greys want to do exactly that, to download their own quantum information mindedness into our naturally made quantum that I call it a morphogenic electrospatial field, this thing that might be called a soul, this thing that is information gathering from the beginning of the universe. All of that in one individual. Can you imagine how precious and wondrous that is? These guys, all they've got to do to occupy that is to hack into it. And then they've got a combination of themselves. Even though they don't know themselves, they're machines after all, they don't know, a machine cannot know itself, that will come into our own modus operandi, individual modus operandi, and continues on as us. We are then nowhere. We are neither phone, we are neither them nor us. And supposing this wonderful thing you call our own individual information field carries on an eternal scale, because we don't know who we are, what we are, being merged with a machine's psychomotive power, shall we say, we will be nothing. We are damned. Each individual is damned. Now, that's how we get into this religious perspective. Now, may I take you then and connect this up to an individual that was born in Palestine 2,000 years ago. Now, I'm not a religious person. I want to say this. I really don't believe in organized paraphernalia that praise the Lord and pass me the money business, you know. Really, that they're really something down to the simply that. In the Sophia of Jesus Christ in the Gnostic texts, right, mm-hmm. It talks about molded beings that were condemned, I quote, as robbers, because here again, I quote, they welcomed the blowing of the breath of God, but they were not able to receive that power for themselves. Could they be talking about artificially molded creations like the greys, like these kinds of synthetic entities that the universe out there and planets out there are producing all the time? He then tells the apostles, this individual, which I'm talking Jesus Christ now, tells the apostles in no uncertain terms that he came to mankind to free them from these robbers who attempt, albeit in vain, you know, to steal our souls from those to whom it rightfully belongs. He says, again, I'm quoting Christ, mm-hmm. he loosed the bonds of the robbers from immortal man and then broke the gates of the pitiless ones before their faces. Could these kind of bonds that are loosed and the gates that are broken perhaps be the gates and bonds which interrupt the genome of mankind, blocking and holding dormant, you know, the full expression, if you like, of the natural, unintercepted genetic scope of humanity. So Jesus describes these robbers as the pitiless ones. Many abductees, you know, have reported the complete lack of sympathy with which the Greys, for instance, appear to have for human suffering.
That's right.
Of course, if my theory is right about these beings, if it's in any way correct, it's easy to see why pity would be impossible for them to conceive of, you know. So there are numerous accounts, you know, Anthony, within many texts in the Coptic Gnostic Library, for instance, in which Jesus carefully explains to his apostles kind of exactly how to deal with the alien beings should they be faced with them. And most notable of these explanations is that given in the first kind of Apocalypse of James. We have to be a bit of a scholar to go and actually get these titles out of the Gnostic library, but that's fascinating reading that puts together the summary and purpose of a absolutely wondrous being that came 2,000 years ago. And I came to believe in that being, not in this so-called church of his, with a bunch of gold lamed scoundrels, as far as I can see, in the Vatican today and all over the world. Let me say, I just indict them terribly. This beautiful being walked the streets of Jerusalem with bleeding feet, covered in camel dung and all the rest of it, struggling against all kinds of odds, was mangled and suffered the most excruciating death, and all he was trying to do, I am convinced, was to warn us that something awful is coming that can take yours and mine and everybody else's natural property of eternity away by downloading a incredible piece of technology, you know. In this text, Jesus, for instance, in this Apocalypse of James, explains to the Apostle James how to cope with these beings who take away souls by theft.
I hate to interrupt, but this is something that's, I feel that is so important, and I know that you more than anyone can provide us with probably the most clearest answer on this, and it relates to everything that you're saying. And again, I apologize for interrupting, but we have seen in recent times, you know, from the Dead Sea Scrolls to the Non-Commodic Codices, essentially groups of, how you describe them, authentic apocryphal texts that were banished to obscurity by a small group of men, you know, like with all the various councils, like the Council of Nicaea. There was, like, I believe, seven different councils. Why this concerted effort to extract the knowledge from, you know, from the libraries of across humanity, specifically in the Near East? Why did they do that?
They burnt it down. I'm just interrupting you. They actually burnt the Library of Alexandria down. There's a report of a witness that says a beam of lightning from a cloud started the fire that took away this enormous repository of our history and our understanding of things. And in that library, there may well have been the greatest gospels of all, the gospel of the other apostles and all the other witnesses to this incredible being that came 2,000 years ago. And of course, that leads on, if I may say this to you, Anthony, it leads on to something absolutely sensational. Because if you can tie Jesus Christ and religion into these Greys, and that's why the book is called, you know, The Harvesting of Souls. Mm-hmm. Sounds bizarre, doesn't it, the title, Grey?
No, not at all, not at all. I think it makes perfect sense.
For common people, that sounds absolutely bizarre. In fact, it wasn't my title. It wasn't my title. It was actually the publisher's title. But I have to say that it is apposite. It is actually pertinent. And what is most crucial to actually stress is that when you get this situation where something artificial comes and, by theft, so to speak, comes into us, and we actually assist this thing happening, the taking away of the premise of our own natural glory, you can understand why some other kind of being from the universe, from perhaps a universe within our own, that's our lighter reality in space. I believe Jesus Christ and the great ones come from these places. Mm-hmm. He came and suffered this incredible ignominy and suffered this awful thing at our hands to simply rescue the property of something these beings from this place realize to be primary and everything of everything, so to speak, the power to continue forever. And that these machines, a simple machine, can actually interrupt that property.
I'd like to read one passage from your book that really resonated for me because of the research that I do and the many people that have come forth to me over the years with stories of their abduction experiences from these grays. And when I read this, this was in Lambs Among the Wolves, which was in your book. I don't remember the chapter exactly, but it read, because I bookmarked it, it said, it reads, these gray roboids, manufactured biomachines, can never be expected to show charity, sentiment, mercy, or compassion. They can only act in a clinically expedient way at all times, responding to the sharp and clear directives of a program set on a binary scale of reference. We are all doomed in their hands if we go on choosing to ignore the awesome threat they present to humanity. When I read that passage, of course, it makes me reflect upon all these, apocryphal references from like the Book of Enoch and the Book of Giants and, various other gospels and, the Nag Hammadi codices, much of the writings within the Nag Hammadi codices. But it also makes me think of various individuals. One that comes to mind, now, he's quite controversial, but he says some things that are on the cutting edge and way out there on the fringe that make you think. John Lear, who was friends with Bob Lazar, and he's the one that brought the whole Area 51 conspiracy to the surface, of the mainstream, where everybody was paying attention to Area 51. It was because Bob Lazar and John Lear were the ones that essentially were out there getting arrested by the Lincoln County Sheriff's Department for looking at UFOs when they weren't supposed to be, because apparently Bob Lazar worked there. But this is the reason why I mentioned John Lear. It has nothing to do with Area 51. It has to do with the fact that he claims that he was given information that describes these grays as cybernetic organisms which are soulless. And that resonates exactly with what you are describing in your book.
Well, look, I'm totally convinced. There's nothing more to say. I absolutely, after so many examples, uncovering so much affirming literature of this particular thing, I'm absolutely certain that this whole exercise that's coming up into our world in the future, in the next few years, is to actually change us into some kind of mechanism where man shall walk as machine. And there are people who love this proposition. There is a chip that they have actually turned out, now many in fact, I'm sure secretly, RFID chip that can be inserted into you that will provide for absolutely everything that a human being would need in terms of medical care, whatever. You will be told that unless that is installed in you, you get nothing. You can't move around the world. There's no passports anymore. There is just, all your medical stuff will only come because you can put this information into a bank of machines that will then look at your prospectus biophysically and prescribe, remedies and so on. That is just the beginning for taking over the proposition of our glorious naturalness, right? We may be humble in our naturalness, you know, Anthony, but by God have we got history that can take us into another frame of reference as the great teachers like Christ and the Buddhist teacher Buddha and the great prophet of Islam, Muhammad himself, taught us this expression of our minds to bring things together, to unite things, has a proposition that beyond death can frame us into another reality that is glorious. I think that these greys, these machines, can interrupt that process for all of us. I'm absolutely convinced of it. And that really is what brought me on to kind of tub thump, if you like, this thing to the world with a series of three books that I've written. Now, I really don't want to teach the world new meanings, Anthony. To be honest, I've got enough getting on with my family and loving them and all the rest of that business that parents do and grandparents do and so on. Honestly. But when I saw this and looked into the eyes, I'm sure you look into the eyes of your children and can even imagine and propose the question, can we take this life and meaning away from them like some electronic device in the future? Well, I'll tell you what, there's no way I will go kicking and screaming against anything like this. And it's guys like you, let me say this, and let me pay you a compliment, that go out there bravely into the world and say these things on the radios, despite what the mainstream and the conspiracy, I'm convinced of it. You know, they say every time they don't want you to look at something and say you're a conspiracy theorist. Well, you can't conspire enough if this is true. Let me tell you, you see what I'm trying to say. Well, I'll tell you, old chap, I'll go out kicking and screaming, and I hope every single human being can go up there, do as I did, an ordinary dad, looking at these things for himself, and see the evidence for it. Don't believe a word I say till you go out there, guys and girls, look at it for yourself. It's out there if you want to know. And I'll tell you what, I am betting you'll come back a convert. I would have bet I would never be converted. And boy, did it do something to me. But I've got a superb research team now who provides all the affirmations necessary, all based on science, by the way. It's nothing I write in that book.
Sure.
It's their premises and surmises, but it's all backed up by solid science, if you see what I mean. The problem is, you see, Anthony, scientists are disparate. They have specialities. They're kind of, you know, in one section. Nobody puts it all together. And when you do that, the full picture emerges, and then you are stunned. So my little boy who asked me that question, are UFOs real, Dad, did me the greatest favor possible.
I agree. I'm very, very impressed with your book. I'm going to continue to read this book, and I'm going to make a strong recommendation to the listening audience that Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, written by Nigel Kerner, is a must-read. For those of you who have followed my research, followed much of the research of individuals like Nick Redfern, watch some of the television shows that are out there that are quite compelling, like much of the Ancient Aliens shows, much of the shows that are devoted to trying to answer the question of what are grays, you know, what do they represent, and what is the true meaning of the human, you know, lineage with respect to our origins. This book is a must read. And I am very thankful to Nigel for having spent an hour with us this evening. And I know that your book is going to be well received among this audience. And I am going to continue reading it. I thank you so much for having sent me this book. Nigel, do you have a website or any information that you would like to share with the audience as we close the show up?
Yeah, one thing. Please don't go by what I say. My website is just nigelkerner.com. You go out there, boys and girls, lads and lasses, and look for yourself, because I tell you what, that's where the metamorphosis has to take place, within you. I had to do it, and I've come to these conclusions. It's a very interesting journey if you choose to do it. And let me tell you, it's impossible, you know, to get this kind of radical change unless you see the evidence. If people come and tell you this, they'll tell you you're out with the fairies, so to speak. But I tell you what, Anthony, what you do and what you say, and I hope this is not a mutual admiration society, but honestly, it's there for everyone out there. And that's the simplest thing I can say. I'm not really too bothered in a sense about what I do and what I write, except in this premise. If I am wrong, it's an interesting read. However, what if I'm right? That's right. That's the question I pose.
Wow. Interesting. Well, Nigel, thank you so much for being with us here on Disclosure Radio on Scepter Radio Network. And it was an honor, and I am so thankful that we had this opportunity. And let's make a schedule to do this again. Let's schedule it out in the future, because I know that there's so much more information that was in the book that needs to be addressed. I would love to.
There's so much to say about this incredible artifact, the Shard of Turin, which I actually include to justify and illustrate all the things I've said. And I tell you what, when you know about this fantastic thing, mate, that's a program and a half.
Wow. Thank you so much. Okay, why don't we do this? Let's do a special on the Shroud of Turin.
Lovely. And I'll tell you what, I have got an expert to end all expert. He's my godson. He's a doctor, a medical doctor. Mm-hmm. And he's the last word in the actual scientific research into the Shroud. So perhaps I can bring him along.
That would be wonderful. Thank you so much, Nigel.
Thank you for joining us for more original Scepter Radio programming, where listening uncovers the world that's been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.